Hey everyone, you're listening to episode 11 of Superhero Speak. In this episode, Ben and I sit down with a very special guest. He's been called your favorite actor that you do not know. He is known for such roles as Abe Sapien from the Hellboy movies and the Silver Surfer in Rise of the Silver Surfer. That's right, boys and girls, it's Doug Jones. Now, this episode was recorded on June 24th over Skype, and Ben and I had a lot of fun doing this. Doug gave us a lot of insight into his career and how he got started, and how he ended up to be known as the most famous actor that you do not know. We had a lot of fun recording this, so sit back and enjoy, and if you like it, let us know on our Facebook page. Here we go.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to Superhero Speak. This is your host, Dave.
And this is Ben.
And today we have with us a very special guest. He has been in movies such as Batman Returns, Tank Girl, Mystery Men, Men in Black 2, The Time Machine, Hellboy 1 and 2, Hellboy Sword of Storms, and Blood and Iron, Dragon Age Redemption, The Guild, Hellboy The Science of Evil, the video game, just to name a few. So, everyone, please welcome Doug Jones.
Well, thank you. That's quite a an introduction to live up to. I hope I can.
Yes. That brings me to one of my first questions. You've been in a lot of movies, and you've actually been called recently. I saw a post where you were called your favorite actor who you don't know, and. And that alludes to, you know, you do a lot of work in makeup and whatnot. And I'm just curious, how do you feel about a title like that?
Oh, no, I'm tickled pink with it. I've been an actor for 27 years now, and working under the radar most of that time. It wasn't until Pan's Labyrinth, really. I mean, the first Hellboy, I was a blip on the radar. But then kind of was able to disappear again after it for a couple of years. And then when Pan's Labyrinth came out, that's when name and face recognition came with me, because I did so much press for that movie. I was the only American actor in the film. Mm-hmm. I've had the luxury of both now. You know, when I think my career's come to a place where if I'm announced at an event like Comic-Con or a film festival or a speaking engagement, you know, I get to be a celebrity that day. But then the next day at Starbucks, nobody knows who I am, and that's just fine, you know?
So it's the best of both worlds there.
It really is. It really is, yeah.
I remember reading something online with the original Hellboy where David Hyde Pierce had actually said after he saw the movie that you had done such a wonderful job, he didn't even want a credit for doing the voice.
And wasn't that nice of him? Yeah. That's a very unusual actor story to have. It was a kind of a sad situation for me that I was offered this fantastic role with the preconceived notion that that they needed to get another actor to voice over. And that had already been discussed before they even came looking for me for the first Hellboy movie. So that was an ideology and a concept that the studio had come up with that was hard for me to reverse. Hard for me to convince them that they didn't need to do that.
Okay.
But then once the movie was done and I had been voicing him, I mean, I did the entire role on set and on film. And they actually brought me in first to dub over myself in just to clean up my dialogue and do an ADR looping session. And but the decision came down like, hey Guillermo, didn't you promise us that we could have an A-list actor attached to this character? And so the list was also the list of voices they had been talking about were David Hyde Pierce, who ended up doing it, but also Steve Buscemi and Kevin Spacey.
Hmm.
So. And that's all a marketing decision. When I was a contact that when Guillermo called me to tell me that that I had been voiced over by David Hyde Pierce, I asked him quite honestly, was this a performance issue? Is there something I need to learn from this? He said, absolutely not. You were perfect in every way, and if we get to do a Hellboy 2, I will you have your voice for that. But for now, this is a studio decision that I couldn't trump. So, and that was fine. I totally understand that. I've never marketed a movie before, so that's their job, not mine. But I don't think any actor wants to see their voice replaced, and that would include me. That would include me.
Right.
But yeah. So David Hyde Pierce, though, was such a gentleman and so just wonderful and so complimentary that he heard my original voice in his earpiece while he was watching my footage and stepped back and said, what am I doing here? So that's when he decided to skip getting a credit in the film, and he did not do any red carpet appearances at the premiere, no press, no interviews, nothing. And when asked why, he said it was out of respect to me, which he did not need to do. I would never have asked that of him.
That's incredibly gracious of him.
Oh, so gracious. Yeah, I've never met the man in real life, so if I do, he's getting a kiss on the left cheek.
Yes, and I do think, you know, for this generation, you're definitely everyone, you know, you are our Abe Sapien.
Oh, well, thank you.
And so far, our Silver Surfer. Now, that was your own voice work, isn't that correct?
Oh, dear, it happened again. It was. But they had secretly been planning all, I mean, I say secretly from me. It had been in the works all along that Lawrence Fishburne would voice over me.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounded a bit deeper than what I'm familiar of your voice work.
Well, when I did the Silver Surfer, I lowered my voice to hear anyway. And then I went back in. I also went in and did all of my ADR voice looping. And we went over all of my dialogue in this voice, like this. And we then went over it a second time with a whisper, like this. And when they ran them together, it was absolutely beautiful, amazing. And I wish they would have kept that sound. I love Lawrence Fishburne. I think he's a fantastic actor. But the sound we had created for The Surfer was something that would have made the Geek Boys wet themselves.
Yeah, it sounds like that would be a very unique sound.
Right, and not only that, it would help, I think, give it a more alien aspect.
Another otherworldly sound, exactly.
Yes. So, to back up a little bit, again, you're known for, you know, doing all this makeup work. What got you into this?
Yeah, accident. I was in some horrible accident, I don't know. I wanted to be an actor since I was a kid, and never knew that this type of career was an option. I didn't even know that. I mean, I'd seen my early horror film viewing was Boris Karloff in The Mummy, or Lon Chaney as the Phantom of the Opera, Bela Lugosi as Dracula. Those are my early horror films, but I never really equated it like that was a career choice that you could pursue. So I didn't. What I connected with also was sitcoms and variety shows with musical numbers and all that. So I thought like the lighthearted, fun, singy, songy comedy, armpit farts and telling jokes. That was the career that I was seeking. So when I came out to Hollywood in 1985, I thought I was going to be a sitcom star. I'm built for as a goofy neighbor. I'm perfect for that.
I couldn't picture that.
Thank you.
Complimentarily.
I took it that way. But that's what I was pursuing. That's what I was after. Not knowing that being a tall, skinny, goofy guy with a mime background from college, that would give me credentials to wear monster makeups and be aliens from outer space and zombies and all the whole nine yards.
I go so far to say, as the preeminent actor who puts on costumes. And
well, you're very kind. My first commercial agent knew that I had a mime background and that I was also a contortionist, meaning I could put my legs behind my head, kind of a one-trick pony. But that had him sending me out for all the auditions for anything that was physical movement involved, or costume work, or physical tomfoolery, or pratfalls, or flexibility. And what happened was, early on in my career, my fourth job that I ever booked in my first year of acting was the Mac Tonight campaign for McDonald's. It was a Crescent Moon headed character that turned into a huge success. Yeah, I ended up doing 27 commercials as that character over a 3-year period. So that's what marked me then all of a sudden as tall, skinny, goofy guy who wears a lot of stuff, doesn't complain about it, and moves well, you know, so.
I totally remember those commercials too, and I don't know what the point of them was, but they were effective.
Right, well, they were wanting it was a nighttime character. That's why the moon, to attract people to McDonald's after 4 p.m.
Right.
Because their breakfast and lunch business always has been good, but they wanted to attract the dinner nighttime crowd, which, you know, it's not an upscale restaurant necessarily, but it is cheap, and if you have a cool cat going, hey, baby, come on into McDonald's at nighttime, you'll go, right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
So people did. They responded. The sales figures after 4 went up, and they kept me around for 3 years.
So after that, was Batman Returns the first, well, say, blockbuster movie that you were involved with?
Yeah. Yeah, I would say that, yeah, Batman Returns was the first big studio film that I had a credit in, yes. And that was quite an experience for me, being directed by Tim Burton and working alongside Michael Keaton and Danny DeVito as Penguin and Michelle Pfeiffer as Catwoman and Christopher Walken.
I can imagine at the time that'd be a very surreal experience.
As Max Schreck, yeah. No, it was just so surreal. It was funny because I was on my way to work the very first day feeling very intimidated. And, of course, I was just cast as a character called Finn Clown. I was one of Danny DeVito's sidekick minion guys. He hung out with the Red Triangle Circus gang, and I was one of those faded clowns that was in the gang. But I was on my way to work. We were filming at the Warner Brothers lot. And on the radio, I heard a DJ saying, well, today starts production on Batman Returns, so good luck, everybody. I mean, they never say this on the radio, so it was that big of a deal.
That is kind of odd.
Yeah.
Well, the first Batman movie, the 89 Batman, that was, you know,
that was pivotal. It changed cinema in a lot of ways in how these types of movies are handled.
So yeah, it was a big deal. I remember when that came out and everyone standing in line to see it. And
yeah. Exactly, and I remember when Batman Returns opened in theaters, that was the biggest box office weekend in history at the time.
Right.
So, yeah, those superheroes are loved, aren't they?
Yes.
Very much so. So you talked a lot about how you got into, like, the makeup-driven type roles. Is that something, and obviously it's something you do very well, is that something you pursue now as something you want to do with your roles?
It's so funny. I am the most passive, docile actor. The career that I have is not because I went out and sought anything. It's because I answered the phone. Mostly. You know what I mean?
So. But it's a good first step.
Yeah, for sure. Basically, I just kind of sift through what I'm being offered, and I guess I've had some good luck with what I've said yes to. You know, I had to audition in the early days quite a bit. And in more recent years, thankfully, I just hate auditioning with a passion because you never put your best work out there and you're nervous and it's, you know, please like me, tap dance, tap dance, tap dance,
right.
You know. So it seems much more, it's totally legit, you know, when they come looking for you right. And make an offer just based on your career. It's very sweet. So I get lots of offers now for everything from big studio films all the way to, you know, low budget independent dramedies and all kinds of things, web series, short films. So for me, it's all about picking the story and the character and the director that'll make it happen for me. And I'll get all that. I'll get most of that from the script and a coffee date with the director. You know. I've been very blessed with what's come out. Now, I've done some crap, too. We've all done crap. Like, I don't want to mention the movie Bug Buster, but there, I just did. And, so if you look that one up, you'll see, like what's on my crap list.
Actually, yes. To get away from comic books for just a moment, you had mentioned Independence. You were actually, I had met you, I'm not sure you won't remember this, and that's fine, Big Apple Comic Con, I believe, 3 years ago. And I was one of the volunteers there.
Yeah.
And I remember when I met you, you had been talking about an independent film you had just done, My Name is Jerry.
That's right. That would have been 3 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. And you talked about the movie with such passion that I went out and saw it. And I had to say it was actually a very well done movie.
Thank you.
And I actually did enjoy it. And it's funny because I actually just recently turned 39. So I'm getting to, my midlife crisis. So I definitely appreciated the movie very much because of that.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, thank you. I hit mine at 40. I did actually have a 40-year-old midlife crisis myself, so that's why I understood the Jerry character so well. But thank you, by the way, for all those comments. That's very, very, very sweet of you to have taken the time to watch it. Of all my human characters I've played, Jerry would be my favorite for that very. I just found him to be so charming, and the story that I was plopped into, it was written just for me by the filmmaker Morgan Mead. So it was just a love passion project. All of it was. I got to film it in my home state of Indiana, and so it was a wonderful trip home for me too. But I like I like playing the entire gamut. Getting to be in a big blockbuster with millions of dollars behind it, and great creature effects makeups and great visual effects. Of course, that's an exciting project to be a part of, but there's also an excitement for those indie films. When a director, writer has the freedom to do whatever he wants to do without a studio over his head making decisions for him, and you get to be creative with how you spend every dollar because you have to make them stretch so far, and you do develop a really tight-knit sense of family on those indie film sets.
Yes. Actually, now that you mentioned your hometown of Indiana and having a homecoming, you've been in a lot of superhero movies. You've done a lot of different projects with, Felicia Day and whatnot. Do you consider yourself a nerd?
I've been nerdy all my life, that's for sure. As far to carry the title of geek, though, I think that's a very proud title to carry. It's not derogatory at all. Nerd or geek, I think it's become very fashionable and very very in vogue to be a geeky nerd. What comes with that is an intellect and a love for other worlds and other languages and other looks and that intelligent people will find. And I love the nerd geek fan base so much. The fans that tend to follow my work are the ones who want to get to know me as a person when we meet in person, as opposed to, someone like Brad Pitt who, gets people waiting in his bushes to marry him because they like his abs. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely a different fan base.
That's a different fan base, yeah. And, of course, we all love Brad Pitt. He's fabulous. He's wonderful. But, I love the geek world, and I like to think of myself as one, even though I'm not nearly as knowledgeable as the geek fans that come up and talk to me. those people know way more about the movies I've been in and the folklore that they come from than I do, the source material too. I study up as much as I can when I'm, when I started doing the Hellboy movies and when I did the Silver Surfer movie, I did have to go back and dive through stacks of comic books and try to get myself up to speed on, the subtleties and how was he written, how was he drawn back in his origins. And I want to honor that for the fans who are going to know that and want to see some of that on film. So my first responsibility is to those geek fans when I'm doing a film that comes from one of their favorite properties like that.
Well, so, I think that's definitely important because I think not everyone does that necessarily. I mean, I think the writers are doing that to a great degree, but not all the actors necessarily do. I think it definitely comes across in your work that you, you take your time and you embody these characters.
Oh, thank you.
And actually, I think that's one of the things that points to your, ability as a great character actor in my mind is it isn't just, the speech, it is the movement and how you move when you're in the makeup and expressing yourself that way. And you had alluded to earlier that you do have a background in mind. Do you find that you fall back on that at times?
Oh, absolutely. The Well, hopefully you'll never see me as a superhero making an invisible box. I hope that was, but that early mime training does carry through to today. I think that acting is a full body experience. You know, when you take on a character, you take him on from head to toe. That goes far beyond just his verbal dialogue, doesn't it? You know, so, I do find myself, even if it's a human character wearing a t-shirt and jeans, you still have to find his posture and his walk and the way he sits and stands. How does he gesture? How does he cock his head when he asks a question? Mm-hmm. So all that gets accentuated and comes way more into play when you're wearing a heavy costume with an otherworldly look to it, or a superhero look to it, or an animal-human hybrid look to it. So many elements come into play that you need to pay attention to and perform and embody and communicate with visually. You know, there's so much visual dialogue that happens between the verbal lines, I think.
Now, along those lines, of the various, because obviously you've done some very heavy makeup roles, which costume would you say was the most restrictive in that respect amongst the things you've had to do?
Oh, golly. Did I mention Bug Buster? one of the reasons I just hated that movie so much is not only was it a piece of crap, but it was also I was wearing a big... I played the mother bug. And you know, the farther you get from human, the more restrictive and hard a character is to play. And, you know, I was an insect. I was a 6'3" insect.
Yeah.
So I had to kind of hunch over, and I had six legs coming out of my sides, and a big stinger coming out of my ass, and wings, and I had a big an insect head that was on my forehead that responded to the way I turned my head. So my face was stuck in the neck of the creature, and I had big fiberglass pincers on my forearms. It was a nightmare.
I can imagine. It sounds like one.
Yeah, but when you're doing it for a movie that you don't even believe in that much, then that's what becomes an arduous task. But a movie like Pan's Labyrinth, when I was in a 5-hour makeup application and costume, you know, build, wearing stilts and clunking around, with finger extensions and, mm-hmm. and half blind with mechanics buzzing around my head to make my eyebrows work and that kind of thing. That's difficult. And add to that reams of Spanish dialogue where I don't speak Spanish. And it was a huge brain job for me too, mm-hmm. to memorize that kind of dialogue and put some emotion behind it.
And I've read that they use like a very old dialect of Spanish for that.
They did. Yeah, they did, but it didn't matter to me. I didn't know Spanish either. I just had to, you know, memorize words I didn't know as it was. And I had to look everything up, and I did translate it all for myself, so I knew exactly what I was saying. I actually did learn language of those scenes so that I could communicate effectively, I hope. So,
yeah.
I think we pulled it off in the end. Gosh, I hope we did.
So. Well, it definitely looked good. I read the subtitle, so I cheated.
No, thank you. as did I, child.
all right. Well, now flash forward to your current work. You're currently on Fallen Skies.
I am, and I love that show.
And I have to be completely honest with you here, I hadn't watched it, so last night I watched it for the first time.
Uh-huh.
And first off, I was pleasantly surprised that even though this is a sci-fi heavy show and there's a definite intricate storyline, I felt like I could jump in and I didn't feel totally lost.
Oh, good.
You know, and... One of the questions I had, well, first off, I'm not going to ask you what happens to your character.
Right, because at the end of the show, you see the plane, I'm in an airplane going down with the President of the United States. So there's a lot to be answered after this.
Yes. But one thing I noticed was that your character sounds obviously very different than your normal voice. Now, is that just you doing a voice or is that post-production?
A little bit of both. I spoke very articulately and as distinctly as I could because he's written that way. Mm-hmm. He's written very intelligently. My character Cochise. Actually, my full name is Chichok Ilsichnich Chotikol, but they call me Cochise for short. I deliver it that way, and then because he's an alien, they wanted to give effect a different sound to it. So you notice I do sound a bit more mechanical, or they've done an electronic enhancement on me in post-production. They lowered my voice a smidge, and they also added an echo effect.
Mm-hmm.
Ever so slight, just so it makes it sound like he's not quite human, which I think it's very effective.
Right. And one of the things that struck me about that character is obviously it's a pivotal role in the story. It's the alien who is now helping the human beings.
Right.
And you have to bring emotion to that character, and you know, you're asked by the president, you know, why are you helping us? And I think mm-hmm. you gave a very, I love the answer that you gave about the flower.
Yeah, thank you.
Never being, you know, in your home world. And, you know, it's interesting that when you write a character like that, I'm sure the writer writes it through human eyes, but when you interpret that character, how do you interpret the emotion for something like that?
Well, I think that my character Cochise is smart enough to know that he has to win over these human beings' trust.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one moment I think that he knew, my character knew, that there was a relatable piece of information there. We all have a long for a sense of home. Earth has been completely disrupted by this alien takeover that happened, you know, two seasons ago on the show.
Mm-hmm.
That's what started the show. And every alien on the show has been hostile and shot at and run from and the whole thing. So here I land and I'm an alien too, and I realize that they don't have any reason to trust me. So I'm here to help. I have history with the Ashveni, the bad aliens, and we've fought them before. We're here to fight them again and help the humans regain their freedom. Well, at least that's what we're saying for now.
Right.
I don't know. I don't know. We'll see where the writers take us. But the question does remain: why? Like, what's in it for me and the Volm population that I represent? What could possibly be in it for us to go to all the effort and expense to find Earth and help them battle back the Ashveni? Once we've defeated the Ashveni, then what? That's the big question that's going to remain through the season. And I forgot what your original question was. Of course,
How do you interpret the emotion in that scene to...
Right, right. And I think it was because of, I think, Cochise finds his humanity as a connecting point to the human's humanity. Well, let's call it my Volmanity. I found that's when I knew I had a story that maybe they could relate to. And that was the winning moment where President Hathaway, played by Stephen Collins, sort of like changed his thinking and thought, maybe I really am an ally. That I also understand what defeat feels like. I understand what it's like to be an underdog, and I understand that what that spirit does to you to want to fight back and regain your people's pride.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good answer.
Thank you.
All right. So again, that's another very makeup heavy role, and this is just a curiosity from my point of view, because I have a lot of friends who are in special effects, and I know that's a very long process.
Mm.
What do you do while you're in the makeup chair to remain patient while they apply the makeup?
This might be the number one question I get, because it does fascinate people to want to know, like, well, what do you do for 5 hours? Well, first of all, the makeup artists who work on me always become like best friends, because, you know, these are the crazy people that doodled in their notebooks in high school and were drawing demons when they should have been studying math. So they're a bunch of creative, fun people. And we always laugh a lot and tell stories and whatever. But you also will have music playing. You'll also, and thank goodness for the Webernet, you know, that you kids are using. If someone has a laptop with them, we can always watch YouTube videos, which I have to admit, if you give me a talking cat with subtitles, I'm in heaven.
There is definitely a lot of, you can get immersed in the internet for, obviously, for
yes,
hours.
Yes, you can. You can run down all the rabbit holes, and so we've done that many a time in the makeup trailer.
Nice. All right, so you did say that Jerry was one of your favorite roles that you portrayed.
Yeah. My favorite human I've ever played.
Yes. Favorite human. Do you have a dream role that you haven't done yet that you would wish you could do?
Couple of them, yeah. I would love to play a benevolent angel, a white-winged good-doing angel. I've played the Angel of Death, which which I had wings on, but it wasn't the same. I would also like to play a classic vampire, like a not a sparkly pretty one, because I'm too old for that. I'd like to play a classic, like Nosferatu or a Dracula, and maybe even film it in black and white. I would love that. And I think I have my Broadway dream. I've never done live stage in Broadway on Broadway. I think it would be kind of fun to do a stage version of a Nightmare Before Christmas if I get to play Jack Skellington. Anybody? Anybody?
That would be pretty awesome. I could see that.
Yeah.
My it's actually one of my daughter's all-time favorite movies.
Oh.
And you're actually in another one of her all-time favorite movies, which is Pan's Labyrinth.
No. Well, how old's your daughter?
She's actually 19.
Oh, 19. I guess she's a six-year-old, and Pan's Labyrinth's her favorite.
So yeah, she would definitely come and check you out on Broadway if you were in that.
Awesome.
All right. Well, we don't want to keep you too long. So actually, we do have a third co-host, and he wasn't able to make it with us today.
Uh-huh.
And he actually had two questions.
Hit me.
And the first one is, we've been hearing rumors for quite a long time now that there's going to be a Hellboy 3. Is there any information that you could give us on that?
You know, I've been hearing the same rumors that you have. and when Hellboy 3 showed up on my IMDb page, it was news to me. I think anybody can people can post stuff on IMDb without being official. You know, there was a time way back a few years ago when I was also like Batman something or other. Somebody made up a Batman movie and had me in as the Riddler, rumored.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah, so I started getting calls immediately. Like, everybody wanted to interview me. Is it true? Well, and it was not. So that was taken down by Warner Brothers, and then somebody else put it back up again. So the Riddler is finally off my IMDb page. So we'll see.
It's funny you mentioned IMDb, because Mike Hogan, who actually was in the latest episode of Fallen Skies with you, he has a credit on IMDb that he was in the Tom Cruise movie, the remake of War of the Worlds.
Uh-huh.
But it's actually another actor named Michael Hogan who's getting started in his career, and he's one of the background characters.
Oh.
And he has contacted IMDb several times saying, hey, that's not me. Can you take it down? And I know this because I met him. I worked with him at a convention about 4 years ago in Philly and in New York. And we talked about this a lot, and he's contacted them several times. Could you please change this, because that other actor's not getting credit for his work?
Right.
And the people at IMDb didn't believe it was him. He had a lot of difficulty getting that changed.
Oh, right, because right, trying to get a change from a known actor to an unknown, right?
Yes.
Oh, bless his heart. Well, he's trying. That's good for him. Yeah.
So in lieu then, I guess, of a Hellboy 3, is there any talk about maybe doing another animated movie? That was his other question.
Oh, right. Well, again, I would absolutely love to, if one were to come about, but I have not been contacted for it, another animated one in the meantime. I would love to. I loved voicing Abe for those so much. Abe Sapien, I mentioned my favorite human character was Jerry, for My Name is Jerry. My favorite costume character I've ever played is Abe Sapien from the Hellboy film. So any chance to reprise him in any format, I would absolutely jump at the chance.
Cool. We would look forward to that
character, yeah.
Let's hope so.
All right. So we mentioned Falling Skies. Is there anything else?
Yes, right now you can look for a web series that I'm in right now, which is absolutely drop-dead hilarious. It's called Research, with a period.
Okay.
Research, period. If you do a YouTube search for Research Doug Jones, you might find it. Also, the production company and the YouTube page is Mildly Fearsome Films. They should have their video player up if you do a search for them.
Excellent.
Anyway, Research it takes place at a research facility where they test fragrances and products and tastes and flavors and whatnot on human guinea pigs like me. That's why I play like their lead human guinea pig guy. And Barry Bostwick is in the show, and he plays one of the scientist lab coat guys running the facility. And he is so frickin' funny. Barry Bostwick,
great.
Yeah, of course, you know him from Spin City. He was the mayor
right,
with
right.
Michael J. Fox, and he's also Brad from the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah, yeah.
So, so fun. So research is, they just put up episode 5 today, and we have eight episodes total to go. So, every Monday a new one comes out, and every Thursday a little mini episode comes out that's hilariously funny. So we have, so if you do a search for that, you'll see, and today, the one that was put up today, episode 5, is the musical episode. So you'll get to see me fake play an electric guitar. And I screech that thing, okay?
Actually, you had put a link on your Facebook page when it first came out, and I did watch the first episode.
Oh, you did? Oh, great, thank you.
Yes, and I loved your character because it was so funny where, you know, you came in, I think, with your blood and urine samples, and you're like, we didn't ask for that. And you're like, well here it is.
Didn't have to. Great.
I think I just found my addiction.
Right.
Check this out.
Oh, it's ridiculous. Adam Hall is the writer director, and he partnered writing with Kale McCann, and they're both friends of mine, and they're just those kind of funny people that you invite them over for dinner just so you can hear them talk. They're so funny.
That's very good.
Yeah.
All right, Ben, do you have any last questions?
No, I think I've got my questions out. I'm good.
Well, I actually have to get to go to a Creature Shop fitting today. I'm doing a short film called The Visitant with John Heder, who played Napoleon Dynamite.
Okay, yeah.
He's actually producing this film.
Interesting.
And it's a short film, and I'm going to play a demon in it for him. So I have to go to a costume fitting about right now. So I have to hop off.
Well, it's been great having you on the show, and we look forward to all those things coming from you in the future.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, well, I didn't even get to mention all the things. I've done a slew of indie films in the meantime that are all listed on IMDb that'll have maybe doing festivals, and that Raise with Zoe Bell and Sherilyn Fenn, to Dust of War with Tony Todd, Love in the Time of Monsters with Kane Hodder, the list goes on. Grayscale with Tim Russ and, Oh, golly, there's so many more, but I just finished, for you Webernet freaks, I just finished a movie, wrapped a film a couple weeks ago, it'll have a wide release, and, it'll be one of those found footage reality looking films I play a character from folklore, but it was started on the internet. That's all I can say. Don't try to guess out loud. I can't answer your questions.
Sure.
So, but it's going to be very exciting and fun we can talk about it when it's released. Okay.
Well, we'll definitely extrapolate on it offline. And
there you go. There you go. You can guess all you want offline. Exactly.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you so much, David and Ben, for taking the time to talk with me. You're delightful, both of you.
Thank you.
Pleasure all on our end.
And have fun at your fitting.
Well, I always do.
All right.
All righty. Bye-bye, you guys.
Bye. Hey, everyone. You just listened to an episode of Superhero Speak. This is Dave. You can reach me at dave@superheroespeak.com. Also, if you're listening to this through the website, did you know you can go to iTunes and subscribe to it? So check us out there.
And this is Ben from Superhero Speak, which you can reach at ben@superheroespeak.com. And did you know you can also follow us on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/superheroespeak.
This is John, and you can reach me at john@superheroespeak.com, and if you want, there's our Twitter account, @superheroespeak.
All right. Thanks, and check us out at those spots.